In the era of the Me Too movement, there has been a heightened public awareness of not only sexual harassment, but misogyny. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. But there may be a deeper problem. Jane Ward has written a new book entitled The Tragedy of Heterosexuality that seeks to explore something more fundamental. She notes there have been efforts over the last 100 years or so to find compatibility through self-help books and coaching. And she joins us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I want to start out, by the way, with a premise which you may or may disagree with, but it seems to me that marriage, historically, except for maybe the last 100 years or so, that it was basically an economic, social, and political extension of the family writ large. That is to say that the daughters were married into other families for position or social or economic purposes, along with the dowry. Sons, on the other hand, were married into other families for similar reasons. And of course, obviously, all with the backdrop of patriarchy. And it only seems to me that within the last 100 years or so that there was this concern about compatibility or how men and women got felt about each other in marriage. That was basically an economic sort of situation, and it didn't really matter whether you were emotionally compatible. Do you think that's true as we move into this era?
Yes. In fact, Don, it sounds like you could have written this book. That's exactly, that's one of the premises that I begin with, or one of the historical facts that I begin with, which is that sometimes people get defensive about the word patriarchy, but patriarchy was really, it was and is an economic system, and it's the system that describes marriage for centuries. And so part of what I'm interested in this book is how do we go from hundreds of years in which women are basically men's property, the property of their fathers, the property of their husbands, and in which marriages are not in any way expected to be sites of companionship or mutual respect or mutual regard. How do we go from that system to one in which now we imagine that straight people are people who really feel a lot of affection for, respect for, care for the opposite sex? And what I found in this book by looking at the last 100 years of marriage manuals, self-help books for straight people starting quite early, actually in the early 20th century, is that this actually has been a difficult transition. This is not something that can happen so quickly. And that's part of what animates all of those marriage books, is that physicians and sexologists and psychologists who wrote them, especially in the early and mid-20th century, knew that men and women didn't actually like each other very much, and that in order to forge a modern heterosexual identity, they were really going to have to figure out a way to get men in particular to learn to like women.
Why do you think that change occurred? Was there some technological development? Even at the 20th, turn it into the 20th century, still large portions of the families were still out on the farms, and women, men and women actually had separate jobs. One, obviously, the men going out in the fields and doing that sort of work, but a woman's job was to manage a household, which was a full-time job. Not only raising the children, but also doing the wash, which might take all day, or cooking, for instance, could take all day, the canning and so on and so forth, that these two actually had separate jobs. Is there some change that occurs, do you think, at this point, at the turn of the century, that changes that relationship then?
Yes. In fact, it's really a confluence of factors. So one of the things that happens is in the late 1800s, some European physicians invent the words heterosexual and homosexual. So obviously people had been engaging in those practices long before then, but the concept that the gender of the person you had sex with makes you a type of person, and especially that might be a congenital condition, something you were born with, that you're either born a heterosexual, homosexual, that doesn't emerge until the late 1800s. So that's one of the factors, because then physicians and sexologists start trying to clarify, what are the features of these categories? How do we know that someone is truly heterosexual, for instance? And so that's part of the work that's happening in the 20th century to define this new category of the modern heterosexual. Another thing that's happening is that we get the first wave of the women's rights movement. And so when early feminists start to point out, you know, this marriage is a really raw deal for women. What are women getting out of this? You see that male authorities, whether they are religious authorities or legal authorities or medical authorities, start to worry about what's going to happen if women don't see that there's something in it for them. And so the notion of romantic love, the notion that women are making a kind, entering a kind of patriarchal bargain or contract in which they, sure, you know, they're going to be subservient and their husband's going to have the majority of the power, but they're going to get something in return for that. They're going to get a lot of protection. They're going to get maybe his devotion. They're going to get, you know, his strength and care for them. And so through the 20th century, we start to see a lot of this emphasis on masculinity as a kind of protective force rather than abusive force. And that gets sold to women as the reason why they should tolerate gender inequalities.
One of the things, before we get to the self-help books, one of the things that strikes me is that if we move right into the 1950s, I think one of the things that happens, aside from the fact that women now obviously come out of the factories, back into a home, the men come back and go to the factories, but one of the things that's happened to their job is that it's been either outsourced or automated. That is, it doesn't take all day now to do all of these tasks that it did, say, 100 years before. And suddenly I think Betty Friedan mentions some of this in terms of togetherness, is suddenly there's something, there's a problem. They don't know what's wrong. And as you move in the 1960s and 70s or whatever, you begin to see women then moving into the workforce. And it does seem to me that at that point, you get even a bit of an inflection, I think, point where that becomes even more significant in terms of what women want, what out of marriage, as well as the changing roles that seem to be taking place as women become more independent.
Yes, I think you hit the nail on the head that when women en masse, I mean, women of color had always been working in the paid labor force, but when white women, middle-class women, enter the paid labor force in the later 20th century, there's a major shift. And what that is that women start to evaluate the story that men had been telling about how hard it is to be a worker in the public sphere. Because a lot of the gender division of labor in the 1950s was based on a particular kind of narrative about how, you know, it was really hard to go out and work in the competitive world, you know, the rat race that men had to endure out in the public sphere. And so when they came home, their wives should look lovely and have their dinner ready and not burden them with their problems. And, you know, that the home was a man's castle. It was a haven from the heartless world. And all of this conveyed, and you can see it in television from that time, you know, if you watch I Love Lucy, is that it was just so stressful to be a worker, and that's why women needed to do all of the emotional care. And I think the other presumption was that women weren't even really working at home, that being at home was a kind of relaxing gig. Well, what happens is when women start to go into the workforce, they realize that story was a bunch of baloney. I mean, if you have ever stayed home all day caring for crying infants, you know that nothing sounds better than to go work in an office where you can, you know, go to the bathroom by yourself and sit in adult meetings and chat with adults all day. You know, so men had really sold women this kind of absurd story. And, you know, the other thing that happens is that women start to realize that when they enter the paid labor force, not only are they going and doing the work that men had done and complained about, but they're going home and then doing all of the child care, all of the house cleaning. So I think all along what's happening for women through the 20th century is realizing that these justifications for gender inequality, they just don't make sense. And the more women experience what it's like to live, quote-unquote, as a man had, you know, the more they realize that they got a raw deal.
Well, one of the things that does strike me, though, and maybe it's an issue that even is today, and that is that women still tend to be the principal caregivers, particularly for children. That is, on the one hand, they certainly have the freedom and the independence for outside, for work in the workplace. But at the same time, they're also then, but they're caught back a little when it comes to then caring for children. And that seems to be the, they're trying to make this transition, but without any help at the home, as it were, in terms of the children and what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely right. And I think that's another, you know, that's also the legacy of really sexist gender ideology, the belief that if you birth the child, then that means you're somehow better able to care for the child. But you know, there's so much feminist research on this now, so we know that, you know, those gender dynamics occur in marriages in which the child is adopted. So it really has nothing to do with birthing the child. It has to do with the fact that we still, as a society, value men's paid labor more than we value women's paid labor. And there's just so much shocking data on this that shows that even when women make more money than their male partner's employment is prioritized in the family. And so this looks like if, you know, that families are much more likely to relocate for a man's job than for a woman's job, regardless of how much money is involved. We know that when someone needs to sacrifice their job to stay home to take care of young children, it's almost always women, regardless of how much money the woman partner was making. So we know that what's going on here isn't just an economic decision. It also has to do with preserving men's ego and sense of entitlement to being out in the paid labor force.
Let me ask you an interesting question that occurred to me, and I'm curious whether or not there's any many studies, but is there, from a biological standpoint, is there a closer sense of relationship with a woman and her child as opposed to, say, for instance, a man? I know, for instance, bonding takes place very early, right after birth, particularly in terms of the chemistry as a body, as it were. But I mean, is there something more going on there, do you think, or have you seen any studies to indicate that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, here's where we have to look at the broad range of ways that humans take care of infants and have always taken care of infants. So, you know, we know that there are gay male couples who adopt infants Sure. and nurture them. There are lesbian couples who adopt infants and nurture them. We know that there are and have always been more communal forms of caring for infants, so that, you know, grandmothers, aunts, other relatives in the family. So while I do think, especially if you have a nursing parent, a breastfeeding parent, that can be, you know, add a layer of complexity around balancing work and breastfeeding, though even that is changing because many workplaces now are actually accommodating breastfeeding parents. But what we know is that any committed parent or guardian, any loving adult, can provide an infant or young child the kind of care that they need. And, you know, what better way to prop up patriarchy, to justify patriarchy, than to make up a story about how only women can be the ones to stay home, because that keeps women in the home.
Right. I mean, because it does seem to me, and maybe what you're suggesting is that women particularly who see themselves or care for children and see that as part of an extension of who they are, that is more perhaps cultural than it is necessarily biological.
Absolutely. And that doesn't mean it's not important. I mean, I think anybody who feels a really strong call to be a very involved parent and to really focus on parenting as the work that they're doing, that, you know, it's not that we should devalue that. It's that we need to make that open to anybody who feels that call, because it's not linked to our bodies.
I want to turn, by the way, now to the self-help books, which I must tell you, some of them really were creepy, to say the least. And we'll get to the creepiest in a moment. But let's just start out with, how did these self-help books come about? I mean, you relate, by the way, to the fact that there was the eugenics movement as well, which seemed to be sort of caught up in these efforts to get men and women to desire one another.
Right. So another one of those factors that's converging around this time is the eugenics movement. And I actually was really, not surprised, but now that I think about it, it makes a lot of sense. But I did not know when I set out to find these earliest self-help books that I would discover that they were almost all written by leaders in the eugenics movement. And for anyone who doesn't know what the eugenics movement was, this was a early 20th century reform movement in Europe and in the United States that was about encouraging reproduction among people of, quote-unquote, good genetic stock, mostly white, middle-class, able-bodied people, and then discouraging everyone else from reproducing in order to create this, like, idealized race of humans. So this was social Darwinism, basically. So I was, I looked at this and thought, why are these folks writing all of the marriage advice books in, from around 1910 to 1930? And what becomes pretty clear is, they are invested in encouraging white people to keep having white babies. They want to see white families flourish. But what they know at the time is that there are many obstacles in the way of accomplishing that. And one of them is that white men are brutalizing white women. So many of these books start out describing how, because they're often, these eugenicists are also family physicians, and so they describe how their patients will come to them and they discover that that women are basically being raped on their wedding night and are so traumatized by that that they really shut down to having sex with their husbands. They find out that many women are repulsed by the sight of their husband's naked body. At this time, women in particular didn't really have access to information about about the bodies of the opposite sex. There were also so many kind of puritanical beliefs about cleanliness. There were, hygiene norms were really different at the time. And so what these sexologists basically are describing is that men and women in marriage often are repulsed by one another's bodies, and that this is a major obstacle to creating the kind of highly reproductive families that these eugenicists are hoping to see.
Can you give us a couple examples of these publications? Give some, fill in a little bit more of a character, what they were like.
Yeah, so there were several who were prolific. William Robinson was one of the most prolific of the writers who published with the Eugenics Publishing Company. Marie Stopes, Havelock Ellis was arguably the earliest to sort of set this kind of work in motion. Many of them described their project as being a social hygiene project. So they were interested in teaching men and women to better understand their own bodies and the bodies of people of the opposite sex, which they hoped that kind of education, that kind of knowledge, would resolve some of these problems. They presumed, and probably rightly, that men had absolutely no idea about female anatomy and did not know how to create pleasure for mm-hmm. women. They didn't know what a clitoris was. They really were coming into a sexual encounter completely focused on their own interests. They also worked with women quite a bit to normalize men's sexual aggression. So it wasn't uncommon that they would say, you know, a certain amount of brutishness is just part of a natural impulse in men. And so if you just can understand that and know that that's actually part of how he is expressing his love, then you'll be in a better position. So sometimes where they went with this too, to address the mutual repulsion, is to say it's perfectly okay to wear perfume, to embrace corsetry, to embrace makeup, you know, because again, they're also working with some patients who are, you know, these rural families who might be Puritans, who believe that that kind of adornment or, you know, using makeup or perfume is ungodly. And so I argue in the book that we're also seeing the emergence in a way of the hetero beauty industry, all of these products that increasingly through the 20th century get sold to make men and women's bodies more appealing to one another, especially women's bodies, because, you know, the story goes that straight men are just really, really attracted to women. But what we know is the reality is that most straight men aren't attracted to women's bodies in their natural state with leg hair, armpit hair, you know, that kind of thing. Most men want highly mediated women's bodies. They want women's bodies to be shaved. They want women's bodies to be makeup. They want women to diet, you know, all of this kind of stuff. So the early 20th century marriage books also lay some of the foundation for those kind of interventions as well.
Because it does, and by the way, it does strike me, if we're going to the pickup artist, that this is also a period, particularly the 1920s and so on, that you're getting an emergence of women at least beginning to shed a lot of the old, for instance, particularly the Victorian image of women and what they should be doing, that there's a certain liberation that's taking place. I mean, obviously we have the flapper in the 1920s, but there's also right. a sense that something's changing for women, and they embrace, like, you know, the Max Factor, who basically creates makeup, as it were. I mean, they... as part of this liberation that they see themselves in.
Yes, I think that the beauty industry has, you know, I want to be careful on how yeah. I talk about this, because I am a person who, you know, I'm queer, but I'm a femme and I do love makeup and I right. do all that stuff. So I'm not dissing it, but I do think that it is hard to parse out when we're engaging with those kinds of consumer products out of a place of liberation and self-expression, and when we're engaging with them because that is the way to be legible or successful as a woman. You know, I don't think anyone really has a hold on that. That's what capitalism is, right? It makes us confused about whether we're buying something because we truly like it or whether we're buying it because we've been brainwashed into buying it.
Right. Now I want to turn to the other section that you talk about, which is the pickup artist industry. So, I mean, how, by yeah. the way, how did you learn about this and describe for our listeners what that's all about? Because I think this was the creepy part of the book.
Yes, it is. It is one of many creepy parts. Yeah. So I had been following this subculture, the pickup artist subculture, since around 2005. It came across my radar because there was a journalist named Neil Strauss who decided to immerse himself in this subculture of pickup artists and then write a book about it. And the book's called The Game, and yeah. it was a best-selling book. The book itself, if you get it, kind of looks like a Bible. It's got that, like, faux black leather and then the gold, you know, edged pages and a little red satin bookmark. And it was, you know, purportedly passed from men to other men as this kind of secret underground weapon for how to seduce women. And so, of course, I bought the book and just became really interested in, like, what's going on here. And I decided that I wanted to reach out to some of these pickup artist companies, because what happened pretty quickly is that it transformed from an underground subculture to basically an industry. So all of these companies popped up in mostly the U.S. and the U.K., but they had like satellites around the world. As they got negative attention, you know, as people sort of started, journalists mostly exposed them as being, you know, lecherous or manipulating women or teaching other men, you know, how to manipulate women into bed, they started to rebrand themselves and started to refer to themselves as dating coaches, relationship coaches, things like that. And so as a sociologist, I was especially interested in that transition, that process of rebranding and how they were thinking of themselves. So when I got permission from a couple of the companies to sit in on their seduction boot camps, these were like seminars in hotel rooms that men could enroll in to learn how to seduce women, I really expected to be pretty turned off by everything that I saw. But what I found was actually much more nuanced, you know, and it was a lot of male suffering, basically, men who felt very vulnerable, who felt like failures, who couldn't understand why they weren't able to attract women. And so I tried to come at the project from really seeing their perspective, and it was a really illuminating piece of the tragedy of heterosexuality, because it turns out that, you know, heterosexuality is not just difficult for women, it's also often very difficult for men.
Okay, so one of the things that struck me was that they were looking for something that didn't exist. I mean, the word lookism, I guess, comes to mind. And you also indicate that many of them said if they were looking for a woman, that they would be white. It does seem to me as if there's a seduction, as it were, of this image that what women should look like and those women that they want, or at least they're told that they want. I mean, because I'm struck, by the way, there was a story that was told about Dustin Hoffman, who did Tootsie. And afterwards he came home and his wife came in and said, well, what's going on? He was very sad. He said, you know, he was sad because he had this potential to meet all these really interesting women, but he didn't because of what they looked like. And it seemed to me that was the sort of facet that really struck me about these encounters that you talk about.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think men, straight men, have been taught, maybe implicitly through the media, that they're entitled to a woman who is younger than they are, that is something that happens all the time. It's a normal thing that a man in his 30s or 40s might expect that he would... You know, let's say we're talking about a man in his early 40s. He might be divorced. Maybe he's a little bit, you know, he's starting to lose some of his hair. You know, if you thought about who would be the equivalent woman for him, that would be also a woman in her 40s. Maybe she's divorced. She might have some kids. But these men often felt like, you know, those women were available to them, but that's just not at all who they were attracted to. They talked about how they didn't want a woman who was too serious or jaded. They didn't want to have to deal with a woman's children. They felt like they still had a lot of time in life for like fun and adventure, and that their best shot at that would be with a younger woman. And so in that environment of the seduction industry, instead of judging that, the coaches say, absolutely, you should get that. You shouldn't have to settle for the low-hanging fruit. And so they, you know, they kind of double down on that fantasy of who men deserve. And it's true that those women are out there. You can find a blonde woman in her early 20s, but what's going on that men in their 40s want that young woman? question.
We've been speaking with Jane Ward. She's written a new book called The Tragedy of Heterosexuality. Jane, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
It was great to chat with you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.